Welcome to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. On Sojourner Truth, we bring you news and views on the impact of U.S. domestic and foreign policy in Southern California and around the world, and how women, communities of color, and others are responding to or opposing those policies. We also look at the interrelationship between art and politics. Today, we have a very, very special one-hour in-depth discussion with Selma James, and it is quite a fascinating discussion, so don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Margaret Prescott. I have as a guest today Selma James, London-based women's rights, anti-racist, anti-war activist in Los Angeles, in Southern California and Northern California recently for a tour, and also on the East Coast in Philadelphia. Welcome to the show, Selma.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Selma, I'd like us to have a chance to really have an in-depth discussion with you, because your work has influenced the women's movement not only across the Atlantic in London, where you're based, and throughout Britain, but also here in the United States, in the Caribbean region, and in fact, throughout the world. So I'd like for us to just have a chance to take a look for our audience to have a sense of who you are, where you're coming from, but also, given the crossroads that we are now with the war in Iraq and the occupation of Iraq and everything happening in the Middle East, for someone living outside of the United States, to give us some insight on your view looking at the movement, the anti-war movement, the movement for change here in the United States. But let's start a little further back than that.
Okay.
You've actually been in Los Angeles before. You lived in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little about that?
Well, when I left school in Brooklyn, New York, I married and came to the West Coast with my new husband and lived here for 7 years. And I was a factory worker and a housewife here. And it was a very interesting, very exciting time for me, because it was the first time that I saw people from all over the U.S. They were immigrants, Okies, Arkies, people from Texas, people who had been in Ohio, but their farms, every year there was a flood and they finally gave up that life and came here. And they were very young and they just wanted to start a new life and live a new way. So everything was up for grabs. It was a very uncertain but very exciting time for all of us. I learned what the United States was like for the first time. I certainly didn't learn in Brooklyn, New York. All you knew in Brooklyn was, well, you knew Brooklyn, but sometimes you also knew Manhattan and the Bronx. But you didn't know what the U.S. was like, and I found out there. I found out a lot about race relations in the U.S. At that time, if you were a black woman, you didn't get into the wiring and soldering factories where I worked. You had to be at least a Latina or white in order to get that kind of job. But I met black women when I worked in a marshmallow factory, you know, packing marshmallows for Safeway or somebody else. So you could see the hierarchy among people, and especially the hierarchy, of course, between women and men. That was also a very important part of the scene, and women trying to find out how they could be different, how they could live a different life, how they could be independent of men. And being independent began with having an independent wage, of course. And if you had children, then you were stuck at home. And then when they were 2 years old and you could put them in a nursery, you went out to work. And then that was really just one job on top of another. And you had to choose, it was six of one and half a dozen of the other. You know, you were very happy to go to work on Monday morning and very happy to get home on Friday night.
Now, you also wrote A Woman's Place during that time. And,
that's right,
and A
yes.
Woman's Place is really now a classic. It's really a precursor, in a way, to what became the modern-day women's movement. How did you become involved in writing that? You were politically active at the time.
I was. I was part of a socialist organization, which then became kind of famous because the man who led it was a man called C.L.R. James, and who was later deported from the United States. And it was very encouraging about the things that I was saying about how you couldn't only talk about men as in factories, or even women in factories, as being the only people who are involved with capitalism, who were doing productive work, and that it was the housewives who were reproducing workers every day, and who were very much part of the working class and very much part of the struggle, and were an autonomous group within the working class who had their own needs and interests, which had to be, and which were constantly expressed. I remember telling him a story about my neighbor and the fact that I had walked into her house one day with my little child, you know, so that he could play with hers. And she had her children's clothes strung all across her front room. And I thought she'd gone mad. And I said, you know, what is it you're doing? She said, I'm selling them. She said, these are the ones they have grown out of, and I'm selling my children's clothes because if I don't get any money of my own, I'm going to go crazy. And it was that remark which rang in my mind for years, and I really feel was what caused me at a certain point in the women's movement to say, look, we've got to go for the money. We've got to go for wages for the work we're already doing.
Yes, and you went on to found the International Wages for Housework campaign that has now grown into the Global Women's Strike, with actions happening on March 8th on every continent in about 80 countries. But before we get to that, just going back again on the heels of A Woman's Place, when you wrote and published The Power of Women and Subversion of the Community, and I know when I first read that book, I was just riveted, and I think many who read The Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community would be. You included in that publication your 1953 piece,
yes,
A Woman's Place.
I did.
Can you tell us a little of how you did that? Because clearly you were then now at a different place than you were, but also recognizing the importance of A Woman's Place and the 50s.
Yes. This is the 50th anniversary of its publication, which takes my breath away because I don't know where the 50 years have gone. But when another woman and I, Maria Rosa Dalla Costa from Italy, got together and we wrote something called Women and the Subversion of the Community, it was perfectly clear that the basic question for women who had formed the women's movement was, is there liberation by going out to work? And the movement has really fundamentally split on that, although we don't know that split so consciously. In other words, there were many feminists, socialist feminists, non-socialist feminists, anti-socialist feminists. They all said, get a job outside the home, raise your consciousness, get your own money, live your own life. And many of us said, first of all, we don't want to live the life that men live on top of the life that women live. In other words, we don't want the two jobs. We also, when we go out to work, we want the power of having money in our pockets already, because we felt that women's wages were low because we had so little social power in the society. And then extending that, we began to look at housewives not only in industrial countries, but in non-industrial countries, what they call developing countries, but that don't seem to be developing at all. What is developing is the amount of work. And women were living and feeding their families all by the same unwaged work that women in industrial countries do. They not only cooked the food, they also had to grow it first. They often had to go for water hours every day or every other day. They had to find fuel to cook the food. And all this work was taken for granted, and we began to see that this work wasn't even entering the statistics of the economy. So they would say, for example, that 15% of women were economically active, but 85% of us were economically inactive. That is, we were working 14, 16 hours a day, every day, but we got no wages, and therefore we were inactive. Now, if you have a situation like that, that means employers can take advantage of you. That means corporations can exploit you in every way, and they always find ways. So that a woman's place began, it drew that line saying, there is no liberation through work outside the home, but a woman's place, nevertheless, is wherever she wants to be. The only thing is, wherever we are, we're working. And by the time of the Wages for Housework campaign in 1972, when I first put forward Wages for Housework, I'd come to the conclusion that we wanted the choice of where to work and when and how much and for how much. And the nub of that question was that we are already working. We're very active economically. We're laying the basis of the whole economy. We're not getting money for it. It's time they paid us. Then we'll discuss among ourselves whether we want to take a job on top of that.
Right. Now, your work has been pioneering, your campaigning, based obviously on your own experiences as a mother, as a factory worker, and on your grassroots activism in the Global South, as well as in the United States and in Britain. And we'll talk about your work in the Caribbean in a moment. But it obviously has contributed to an international redefinition of work from being synonymous with wages. And you actually coined the term unwaged work. Nevertheless, for many in our audience who might have come out of women's studies programs in universities and who may or may not have heard about the Wages for Housework campaign, or who may or may not have read The Power of Women and Subversion of the Community, but nevertheless, there's no question that this whole area that you really pioneered of a redefinition of work and coining that phrase has had a fundamental impact not only on the women's movement, but really on how we look at work and North-South relations. Can you comment on that? And can you also comment on a kind of an industry that has sprung up
Yes.
around this, yet Selma James may not be a name that is generally known?
Well, that's...
How could that be?
Well, that can easily be. I think redefining work really hit a nerve in women worldwide. And, you know, the society is not homogeneous. There are different kinds of people in it. Housewives immediately said, this is applicable to me. I can see that when I go for divorce, I am entitled to half of whatever my husband has because I have contributed by my work to the family wealth. Working class women generally know when they're working and are really glad to have it affirmed and confirmed when you say you are entitled, we are entitled to wages for that work. Academic women had a different view, and this is in general, but not necessarily every single one. They said, oh, look, we can start to discuss this, and they immediately called it not the debate on wages for housework, but the domestic labor debate. Now, I have to confess to you now that they wrote about what I said and they wrote about what I didn't say, and I hardly read any of it. That's why I never replied, because I didn't even want to spend the time trying to find out what they were saying in language that was very dense and seemed to take the argument away from a living woman, any living woman. So what we decided to do was something quite other, and I'll speak about that in a minute. But it is very important to note that we do live in capitalism, and the one thing about capitalism is that everything in capitalism is very capitalistic. And the thing was that an industry was born on that. What we as a campaign did from 1972 is to try to find out what kind of political activity, if women were doing all this work, then women had a real problem being politically active. And we tried to find out what kind of activity we could be involved in with women on the basis of the amount of work that women were doing. We started with petitions. We had a petition on family allowance in Canada and also in England, because their mothers got money depending on how many children they had. The state gave them money. It was an enormous battle both in both countries and in many countries of the world, in most countries of the world, but women do get money everywhere outside of the United States in industrial countries.
So that's different from welfare.
That is very different. A woman is entitled to it. The Queen of England is entitled to her child benefit. Mind you, I don't think she bothers, because it's not really enough to pay for, you know, a cup of coffee at her breakfast. But she's entitled to it, which means there is no stigma attached. It is not on the basis of poverty. It is not means tested. It is a woman's right to money. And that's the kind of choice that I like. And it is widespread, and they decided to take it away from women in Canada, and they decided to do something else to women in the UK. And we immediately started a petition campaign, because you could go door to door, you could speak to women. You could speak to women at the post office where they collected their family allowance. And you could get their signature and let them know what the government was planning. And we were able in both countries to stop them reducing the family allowance to women. So that was the first activity that we found that women could be involved in that was in women's immediate interest. Now, by the way, women got it whether or not they worked outside the home. That was money for the children, had nothing to do with what else they were doing and what else their husbands had or didn't have or were giving them or weren't giving them, which was an important part of why family allowance was so important to women. And then we went to the United Nations in 1980.
Yeah, before you get to the United Nations, though, you talked about the family allowance campaign both in Canada as well as in the UK. So again, you're talking about on both sides of the Atlantic. So you began as an international.
We did.
Why was that important? Why? How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, you know, I, in a way I know, and in a way I don't. In a way I know because I was trained, you know, by James and by the organization that I was involved in, that there was a world, and where there's a world, you've got to put it together. but also, you know, I always find the left a bit peculiar. I mean, I come from the left, obviously. I don't come from the right. They talk about unity all the time. They say we must unite. But they never look at who must unite with whom and how to make it happen. And they don't think that we can unite internationally, because they do not begin with the situation of the people who are in the position of most work and least resources and money, and build what they think and what they propose to do on that. And I don't think you can have unity if you start with the people on the top. You have to start with the people on the bottom. So in that sense, I see, because I knew that you have to begin with women, you know, then you begin with women everywhere. But on the other hand, I don't know why we started as an international. It was really just an instinctive thing. And I think because we began in 1972, that the whole movement of the 60s had begun to weld us into a global movement. And I think the Wages for Housework campaign must have been an expression of that.
Yes, because that campaign had a global influence, obviously. And then there was sex, race, and class.
Right.
And can you tell us a little about that and the importance? I mean, why has that work been really pivotal to the campaigning that you have done?
I think because I was very involved in the anti-racist movement, and I was very involved in the women's movement at the same time, and never the twain did meet, because the anti-racist movement was sexist up to its eye teeth, and the women's movement was racist to the same degree. And I could not divide myself. To me, to be against racism and to be against sexism were one and the same thing. And what I began to understand from the women's position was that black people internationally had lower wages and less resources. And I began to see that there was an international hierarchy which included women and men of all races, so that in 1972, when the campaign began, the wage hierarchy in the United States was black women at the bottom, then white women, then black men, then white men. And I said, if that's where the money is, that's where the power is, and that is the hierarchy in which we are all living and being trained. Later, I understood that immigrants, Latinas, were below black women, and then in the next generation rose above black women. And then there was a tussle, and white women from the feminist movement began to rise up over black men who dropped down. I mean, there are many variations and many changes that have taken place, but the hierarchy remains, although its structure is altered one way or the other. And that hierarchy is what we must break if we are to unite. And the only way to break that hierarchy is to start again from the bottom and demand that everybody from the bottom move up, so that we all move up and out of the hierarchy. And that's what I tried in my own way to say in Sex, Race, and Class. And it was the basis, having said the hierarchy must be broken, it was the basis of sectors who are less powerful, like women in relation to men, like black women in relation to black men and white women. It was the basis of autonomous organizing, which the campaign reflected, because black women took their autonomy, prostitute women took their autonomy, women with disabilities took their autonomy, lesbian women took their autonomy, and it was on the basis of that autonomy that we built an international campaign which has lasted and grown and developed and stayed on top and not fell behind, didn't fall behind all those years. It was autonomy that enabled all that.
Right. Tell us, in that same period, in the period of the 60s and the early 70s in the United States, there was a welfare rights movement that had a tremendous impact, not only on women's autonomy,
yes,
and women's autonomous voices, but on the civil rights movement generally. Can you say whether or not that movement had an influence on the campaigning that you were involved in at the time, and in what way?
Well, I have to give you a personal experience I had in the in 1969. I came to the United States, and a friend of mine was a social worker in a welfare office in Detroit, which was really the center of working class activity at that time. You know, Motown had a lot to recommend it. And she called me. I was at home and she, with the people I was staying with, and she called me and she said, there's a picket line around my office. I said, how do I get there? And she said, you take such and such a bus. And I went down, met the women, and they were shouting, the moon don't wear clothes, we do, because they were demanding a clothing allowance, and they had just had a moonshot and threw a lot of money away, you know, doing that. And it turned me around. Most of the women were black, and they were determined to get the money. And I said to myself, this is a very good idea. And look at the women, how strong they are, how organized they are, how determined they are. This is something that the women's movement has to know about.
Thank you very much, Selma. We are going to return for more discussions with Selma James, internationally known women's rights, anti-racist, anti-war activist. We'll be right back. Today we're talking with Selma James. She's based in London, England, originally from the United States. She is a women's rights, anti-racist, and anti-war activist, known and respected on both sides of the Atlantic. She is one of the international coordinators of the Global Women's Strike, whose theme is invest in caring, not killing, opposing war and calling for society to value all women's work and to prioritize caring of people and the environment, not war and profit. Selma is one of the organizers of the grassroots women's picket outside the Houses of Parliament in London, where she's based. And she's also recently, when she was in the United States, spoke at the anti-Bush rally when Bush George W. came to Los Angeles. Selma is the founder of the Wages for Housework campaign, which has developed into the Global Women's Strike Network, active in over 70 countries on every continent, with women centers in Africa, Europe, Latin America, and the U.S. She is a true internationalist. Selma was part of the recent Global Women's Strike delegation to Venezuela and helped to make the film that some in our audience might have seen, Venezuela, a 21st Century Revolution. Thank you, Selma. We're rejoining you. Hopefully, some in our audience heard our earlier segment with Selma James. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Selma, I would like to move on and talk just very briefly about the work at the United Nations, because I know there was a time that your campaigning involved work in the UN, and I'm glad I played somewhat of a role in that.
You did.
And you now have a different position on the United Nations, and there are controversies around it. I mean, Malcolm X did say, go to the UN.
That's right.
Which as the Wages for Housework campaign and the networks affiliated with the campaign, of which there were several, including the International Women Count Network, did in fact go to the United Nations. Tell us a little about that work, what the network was hoping to achieve there.
Well, first of all, in 1975, there was the first women's conference, out of which came a UN decade for women. And it was held in Mexico. And to hold an international women's conference in Mexico in 1975 was to have a mini political explosion, because the first thing that the women did was to have their own forum. That is, the governments could talk in one building, but they began to talk among themselves in another. And Mexican women spoke about not their careers, but about all the work that they were doing on the land, in the home. They confronted women from the United States who, they said, were not in touch with their interests. At the same time, governments were also beginning to speak about counting this work and making some accounting of the unwaged work that women were doing. Two women from Mexico who were part of the network came to New York, came out part of our Wages for Housework network, came to New York at the time when I was there to tell us about what had happened in the conference. And you know, sometimes it takes time for the penny to drop, but sometimes it drops right away. And I said to myself, what can we do at the United Nations? Now, the United Nations at that time was not only a forum for the most powerful, the G8, the most industrial countries, it was also a place where the third world countries went to make their case, to discuss among themselves, and to lobby the industrial, the most powerful countries for what they wanted. So this was our opportunity also to see what third world governments had to say to us when we said about counting the work. And in 1980, in the mid-decade conference of the UN Decade for Women, some of us went to Copenhagen. And Margaret, that's where you began to shine like a great star, because there was somebody talking about, it was Resolution 103, which had to do with counting women's work. And we said, Resolution 103, all our work in the GNP. And we went round the conference, if you remember. And we went to the American delegation. They didn't want to know. We went to the Russian delegation, the Soviet delegation, and they said women in the Soviet Union didn't do any housework. I mean, there are big lies, and then there are so many lies that you can't even tell how big the lies are. This was the biggest. But we went to all kinds of other countries, and we went to the women in those countries because, again, the women had had their own forum, not part of the government delegation, but, you know, discussing among ourselves, and all the women wanted it. The Arab women wanted it. The Israeli women wanted it. The women in the East wanted it. The women in the West wanted it. All the women said, yes, our work should be counted. And it wasn't. The governments didn't agree. They had some other thing on their agenda that they thought was more important for them, not for us. But we knew we had an issue that women wanted dealt with on an international, on a universal level. So by 1985, at the final conference of the UN Decade for Women, Margaret was one of the leaders of our delegation. We had women from a number of countries by then. We had the Women Count Network, and we went to Nairobi, Kenya, for the final conference, and we read the proposed document, took the resolutions that we thought we could amend to make them suitable for our demands. We had status, non-governmental organization status with ECOSOC at that time, which meant you could go into the government conference and lobby the governments. Only we discovered that women were happy to be with the governments and didn't lobby anybody, not us.
ECOSOC is the Economic and Social Council of the UN.
That's right. And we lobbied. We cajoled. We flattered. We gave information. We discussed. We made ourselves complete nuisances until we found a sister. Was it from Sierra Leone?
Sierra Leone.
And that sister was part of the government delegation of Sierra Leone, and she really dug what we were saying. And she went to bat for us. And it was a very dramatic moment when she offered our amendments to the governments, and we sat there with bated breath because we couldn't speak, and watched her manipulate these men and say, just one little amendment here and just one little word there. And she got all she wanted. The United States walked out. They didn't want to vote against us.
That was a delegation headed by Maureen Reagan. This was during the Reagan administration, and the head of that delegation was Ambassador Keys, that black Republican
that
some in our audience would recognize. He's made a few runs as for president of the United States.
Yes.
Yes, that was quite a moment. That was in 1985, and in 1995, then at the UN conference, World Conference in Beijing, much stronger language was won with the backing of more than 2,000 non-governmental organizations.
And
really,
you headed our delegation then.
Yes, and it was really the largest block of women going into the Beijing conference. But tell us, just playing advocate a moment here, there's some in the feminist and academic circles who had been saying, well, wages for housework are counting on unwage work, all well and good for women in northern countries and in industrialized countries, but this has nothing to do with women in the global south, the so-called third world. What is your view with that? What has been your experience
with that? It has been exactly not the opposite, because it has been at least as applicable to women in the third world as in the industrial world. And women in the third world know that it is a vital component of their lives that this work that they do without wages and without any social recognition, in fact, be recognized. And it was immediately put into use by women in the third world. There were women in East Africa who lobbied to change the laws on inheritance on the basis of the work that women did, because wives did not inherit. The family of the man inherited if he died, and she was often put out of her own home if he died. And they said, no, look at all the work that women are doing. Look at all the work your daughters are doing, which is not acknowledged. Don't you think the laws should be changed? And they got the laws changed on that basis. And many other things were changed for third world women, not only when we won something, but even when we were fighting for it, the very fact that there were people in the world who were acknowledging this enormous burden of work that third world women were carrying. So it was applicable to us in industrial countries. It was applicable to us in third world countries, in the countries of the global south, and it was applicable to our relationships not only with the government, with employers, but with individual men, that they whom we had kept alive by our work, whom we had fed, whom we had nurtured, whom we had cared for, you know, all of which is work when it's on the market, that they had to acknowledge their debt to us, so that we were not the dependents because they had the money. They were dependent on our work in the same way as we were dependent on theirs. That's the basis for an entirely different relationship between women and men.
Yes, and it strikes me as a piece of racism, frankly, to look at women in the global south as though it's some other species.
Yes.
I mean, clearly, those of us from the global south carry a much greater burden of work, in fact. But the idea that somehow in the global south, we're not doing housework or we're not doing caregiving work when we're spending hours on end just bringing the water to cook the food or to collect the wood is just an outrageous piece of racism, and is really a way of making those of us who are from the global south invisible.
Yes, that was absolutely our case. But there is something else that was going on, which we have really tackled recently, and that is that if you think that liberation lies with a job outside the home, then who is going to do the caring? Well, caring was often dismissed by feminists. Taking care of your own child was much less important than cleaning toilets in some office. And we said,
as long as they weren't the ones cleaning the toilet.
Indeed, they were in the office, but not cleaning the toilet. When we said, invest in caring, not killing, in response to the military budgets, which had escalated, and cuts in welfare and wages and social programs and housing in order to pay for that war budget, we were reaffirming that it's not that we want to give up caring in order to be liberated. We wanted men to join us in that caring so that we were both liberated.
Absolutely. Let's fast forward a bit, because if you would believe it, time is moving on and we don't have that much time left. I said earlier in our earlier segment in talking with Selma James that we would touch on a bit of her work in the anti-colonial struggle, the struggle for independence in the Caribbean region. And you were recently in Venezuela, where President Chavez, you were invited there as part of the Global Women's Strike delegation. And certainly President Chavez is now talking about the unification of the Americas. Can you comment on that as it relates to the struggle that you yourself were involved in, along with your husband, who's now deceased, C.L.R. James, for the independence movement in the Caribbean region and also for the Federation in the region?
Yes. In 1958, we went back to Trinidad, his home country, because the Federation had begun and the West Indies was moving. The 10 islands that made up the West Indies, were moving towards independence. And between independence and federation, the people of the West Indies, as I knew them, were much more interested in federation.
Right, the West Indies now the audience would know as the Caribbean region.
The Caribbean region, mm-hmm. Yes. But it was called the West Indies then, and it was the West Indian Federation that was initiated in 1958. And we were there till 1962, the year that both Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago became independent. But it was not independence that was crucial. They knew, the people knew, that they would be independent only if they were federated. That is, that the basis for independence was not to have some politicians who were black replacing those who were white, who had a Creole accent rather than an English accent. What was important is that the people were together and they built up a federated economy. That's how people felt about it, and they were absolutely right. And when recently I heard Chavez say, you know, that we must build, you know, our connections, draw out our connections with other Latin American countries, and Africa, he said, is very important to us. And he said, we are as much pained by what happens, by what people suffer in other countries, as we are pained by our suffering here in Venezuela. I said, this is the man for me. Mm-hmm. Because here was a man who said, he said, the market is killing us. Let us, we want the economy, but that is not the economy we want. That is not our priority. He was really talking about the world that I saw in the West Indies so many years before, the world that needed to be built. And he saw the grassroots, and first of all, grassroots women, as the people who are building that world. And I think that Venezuela has much to teach us everywhere in the world, industrial and non-industrial, and we have to learn how to be useful to it, because it is being useful to us, telling us which way the world must go and how to do it.
Yes, let's. We're on the Global South, and let's touch a bit on Africa.
Yes.
President Chavez spoke about Africa. We were all very moved by that. And of course, Africa has been in the news recently because of George W.'s trip to Africa, where he, by the way, referred to slavery as one of the great migrations. I don't know that most of us would agree to call it that. But you are the co-author of a book entitled The Milk of Human Kindness, Defending Breastfeeding from the Global Market market and the AIDS industry. What is the importance of that publication as it relates to Africa? What is the attack happening on Africa and the resistance that women in Africa are making to that attack?
Yes, I'm really glad you said the resistance that African women are making, because, you know, racism, the first effect of racism on an international level is that struggles that people make for their own survival, for their own determination, for their own freedom, are completely obliterated from our vision, so that we don't know the kinds of struggles, for example, that African women have been engaged in, the struggles against Shell in Nigeria, the struggles to grow food for survival rather than cash crops in East Africa, in Kenya and other places. The struggle also to feed our families and to, walking those miles to get that water. You know, that the struggle for survival is done with some anger at the resources of the world being everywhere except in the carer's hands. So that one of the things that when we look at what Bush is proposing to do, we see that he's interested in Africa, but he's definitely not interested in Africans. He has no interest in the work that women are doing. What instead he is interested in is a budget to be given to the pharmaceuticals to deal with AIDS. Now, I do want to say something about AIDS. And I must say, first of all, that breast milk is not only the first milk of infants, it is often, for most of the world, the only food that infants can have. 1.5 million infants die every year because they do not have the breast milk they need.
And a lot of that is in Africa.
A lot of it is in Africa, not only, but very much in Africa. The slaughters in Africa are, we haven't time to discuss all those today. But what he and others are planning to do is to give mothers whom they say are HIV positive and therefore may one day get ill with AIDS. All of this is to be proved. The research is very lacking, to give mothers medicine and to give babies formula. And the only result of that will be the deaths of babies and ultimately the deaths of mothers as well. And he's put the head of Eli Lilly, a major pharmaceutical company, the head of Eli Lilly in charge of the dispersal of funds for AIDS, which means he will drug the hell out of Africans and other people from the third world and make an awful lot of money, while many of us, many, many of us will die from these drugs, which are diabolically bad. You know, they don't cure us. What they do is they kill us. And there's a lot of evidence for that. And we put that evidence in the book called The Milk of Human Kindness. So can I say that it's really three things that the book does? It says breastfeeding is valuable socially. It says breastfeeding is valuable economically, and it puts a price on it and shows how women can count our work. And it shows what the pharmaceutical and the dairy industries, the formula industries, have tried to do, you know, which is absolutely genocidal, by undermining breastfeeding mothers, by refusing to acknowledge the basic question, which is food security for nursing mothers, so that our infants die. And any infant that dies anywhere in the world is our infant. That's what we have to remember. That's what they're trying to train us out of. And we reaffirm every a child that dies, every human being that dies, is some mother's daughter and some mother's or some mother's son, and we refuse to allow it.
Yes, and what is not widely known is that when you spoke recently in East Los Angeles, you talked about the United Nations being privatized.
It has been.
And organizations like UNICEF, like the World Health Organization, you know, now getting money from multinational corporations, including McDonald's.
Yes,
and McDonald's. The formula industry is back in a big way. Nestle's is back.
It's back. The baby killers are back. And we have to see that they are the ones that are killed.
Right. And I'm glad, Selma, that you did stress and talk about the struggles that women in Africa are making. But that's obviously true everywhere we are. And you're discovering that with the Global Women's Strike. We only have very, very few minutes left. And perhaps you could just share a little bit, just give us a quick bird's eye view, because we know it involves Indigenous women and domestic workers. Could you just...
Yes. There's the women in Uganda who walked for days without food in order to have 1,500 people in rural Uganda to have an event as part of the strike. They're the domestic workers in Peru and also in Trinidad and Tobago who had strike events counting the work of domestic workers and having a reasonable wage if you are a domestic worker. Indigenous women in Peru, Argentinian housewives, a very important part of the campaign, Irish women, Spanish women, women in the Cameroons who want to have a special strike event for Africa Freedom Day on the 31st of July, and maybe you'll be hearing more about that. Women in India organizing in 400 villages against the caste system and for tribal women and the lowest caste to be able to use all the resources, against rape by employers, for pay equity with men. All about... Women have had these fantastic events with these fantastic demands. But the first demand of the strike, of everybody in the strike, is payment for carers and for caring work, resources for carers from the military budgets. Pay women, not the military.
Yes, thank you very much, Selma James. I'm afraid we are out of time. We'll have to have you back. Selma James recently spoke at a video cafe in East Los Angeles, where she spoke about the U.S.-Israeli partnership in the Middle East, the centrality of that relationship to the invasion and occupation of Iraq and economic control of the region. We didn't even have time to discuss that further with you. Selma, who has demonstrated great courage in consistently voicing concerns of unwaged workers, considered by many to be marginal and therefore unorganizable and uncounted, and putting an economic price tag on women's unwaged contributions obviously establishes women's entitlement to economic independence, secure housing, access to clean water and healthy food, healthcare, social benefits, and all the civil, economic, and human rights that have been long denied women everywhere. Her campaigning has fought to establish that although women's work is not counted, it is counted on by governments and policymakers to pick up the pieces after economic restructuring and structural adjustment programs have destroyed local economies, environments, and communities, and dismantled hard-won services and benefits. Selma James, it's been a privilege to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
We are out of time. Today's show was produced by Margaret Prescott. Of course, warm thanks to engineer on the Mark Maxwell and all who helped to make this show possible. Also, thanks to Alan Minsky for his help with today's show. We would like to hear from you. You can email me directly at margaretprescott@kpfk.org. If you would like a copy of today's show, contact the KPFK archives at 1-800-735-0230. I'll be back next Tuesday for another edition of Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
been listening to the Sojourner Truth edition of The Morning Review, heard Tuesday mornings from 7 to 8 on Southern California's community station KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and live at kpfk.org.